Blog Talk Radio.
I'm Saffron Sinclair, one of the four finalists in Miss Horror Fest, and you're listening to Movie Geeks United on Blog Talk Radio.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
On the Declaration of Independence, it is written, all men are created equal. No matter how hard you try, you can never erase those words.
Supervisors, it's my duty to make this announcement. Both Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk have been shot and killed. The suspect is Supervisor Dan White.
That was the heart-wrenching announcement made on November 27, 1978, by then San Francisco President of the Board of Supervisors, Dianne Feinstein. The lives of Mayor George Moscone and Harvey Milk, the first openly gay elected official and much beloved and inspirational figure within the community, were tragically cut short by an assassin's hail of bullets, an assassin who had previously been considered a pillar in the community, fellow supervisor Dan White. And in the new film, Milk, directed by Gus Van Sant and featuring an Oscar-caliber performance from Sean Penn, that film tells the story of Harvey in rousing fashion. But 24 years ago, actually, filmmaker Rob Epstein followed the legacy of Milk in his own documentary, The Times of Harvey Milk, which won an Academy Award that year for Best Documentary. And we will be chatting with Mr. Epstein in just a moment. But first, this is Movie Geeks United. I'm your host, Jamie, and your other host tonight will be here with us too. Say hello.
Yeah, that's Jerry. I'm here. I've been here the whole time. I'm in the chat room.
That's right. So if you're listening, log on to the chat room. It's going to be a lot of fun. It'll pick up as the show goes on. It always does. Some great talk goes in there. A great show for you guys tonight, as we said, Rob Epstein. And also two composers, Michael Wandmacher and Alex Werman, who have new films out. Punisher Warzone for Michael. And
Four Christmases for Alex.
Four Christmases for Alex, yes. So some more great composing talents tonight. How have you been, Jerry?
I've been okay. How are you doing?
I'm okay. I just discovered, reading that aloud, that I'm unable to read this evening. I'm stumbling.
Better than I would be doing, that's for sure. So I wouldn't. Don't knock yourself, okay? I mean, I know I don't set the bar very high, but don't knock yourself.
Well, we've had a good couple of days. We've done several pre-recorded interviews, including the one with Mr. Epstein tonight.
Today we did Rod Lurie, his upcoming movie Nothing But the Truth, and also the director of The Contender and Deterrence and The Last Castle, which just went swimmingly well.
He was an exceptional guest, and that interview will air Sunday night, as will director Salvador Stable. His new movie, Where God Left His Shoes, just got a rave in Entertainment Weekly. Which I just read all of their reviews. They got all of them posted up there, including Adam Resurrected and The Day the Earth Stood Still. And
what kind of reviews is The Day the Earth Stood Still getting?
E Weekly gave it a C-.
Okay. No, because this is all I'm going to say about the movie. Keanu Reeves is no Michael Rennie. All right, and I'm going to leave it at that.
Yeah. Michael Rennie isn't even really Michael Rennie anymore.
I know, but I mean, I'm just kidding. I don't know. I'll tell you
wrestler,
about it on Sunday if I see it.
They reviewed The Wrestler. They gave that an A. Owen did.
Mm-hmm.
They reviewed Gran Torino. They gave it an A-. Lisa did.
Okay. These are all very good so far. I'm not complaining. The reviews have been awesome. Anthony Lane's review of The Wrestler in The New Yorker, I would advise everyone to read, because he really is a light on the two of us, and Chris, I'm sure, as well, a diehard Mickey Rourke fan from back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And he just gives it gives Mickey a superb review.
Yeah.
I've never read this. You don't read Mickey Rourke, awesome review in The New York, or at least you haven't read it in a good 20 years, but
it's been a while.
It's there.
Yeah.
It's incredible, the reviews this is getting.
And they give Nothing But the Truth a B+.
Okay, cool.
Owen does. So, tis the season for great films, my friend.
I know. I'm still waiting to see Frost Nixon. That still hasn't opened here, so.
Right. And also next Wednesday, I'm jumping ahead of myself. We have Golden Globe coverage with the three original movie geeks, myself, Jerry, and Chris, do a little round table. Those nominations get announced tomorrow morning. And then next Wednesday, we have our Curious Case of Benjamin Button show, and so far we have Claudio Miranda, cinematographer extraordinaire, confirmed for that show, and other talents will be announced in the coming days. By all accounts, just a gorgeous film and a gorgeous-looking film, as any Fincher movie would be.
Steven Spielberg gave it his endorsement after the screening the other night. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he is, I think it was on Deadline Hollywood, that he has given it his blessing, and that just made everyone's day. Brad Gray is still ecstatic about it, so.
Yeah.
So. He gave it, I mean, right there, there's your, as they said in the article, that's the beginning of your Oscar push for the film.
That's true. And is it me, or does the movie seem like David Fincher does Frank Capra?
There's a lot of that in there. I definitely see that.
Yeah.
That's a very good point.
It just popped in my head.
No. I mean, it's a fascinating, it looks like a tearjerker, at least in the trailer that I've seen. But that's such a very good analogy. It's very interesting you bring that up, because two of the, I think, the most visionary directors of the last 20 years have films coming out this Christmas. You have the Aronofsky's Wrestler and Fincher's Benjamin Button. And they are both different films from them. So this should be very interesting to see.
They are different. They are different for both of them. You're right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let's get to our show.
Let's get the milk.
Let's get the milk. This is a very nice conversation. Our first guest tonight is Rob Epstein, a two-time Academy Award-winning filmmaker whose work, particularly on the topic of homosexuality in America, is provocative, insightful, and heartfelt. In this conversation with Mr. Epstein, we discuss, among many other things, the origins of his film, The Times of Harvey Milk, and what he believes will be Harvey Milk's ultimate legacy. Here we go. Let me ask you about your beginnings and when you started thinking that documentary film was the path you wanted to take. How did that occur?
Well, it occurred at a very young age. I moved out to San Francisco when I was 19, and I thought I was taking a leave of absence from college on the East Coast. And while out here, I got into filmmaking, starting out as a volunteer production assistant on a documentary, and that set me on a path, and which I've been on ever since.
Yeah.
And the first film I worked on was a documentary called Word Is Out, which probably most listeners listening to the show have never heard of, but in fact was a very important film for a generation of gay men and lesbians. It was really one of the first documentaries about gay people made by gay filmmakers at a time when there was nothing on television or in the movies and even in the New York Times. So it was a different, very different period in our history.
Did you attended at AFI, am I correct?
Well, that was in the 90s. I was in a program called the Directing Internship Program through the American Film Institute, and they placed, every year they would place one fellow on a feature film, and you just got to be on the production from start to finish, essentially tagging along with the director. And ironically, the two films I was invited to be on, one was Rambling Rose with Martha Coolidge, and the other was directed by Martha Coolidge, and the other was My Own Private Idaho, directed by Gus Van Sant.
And you chose Rambling Rose, didn't you?
I did. And that's a whole other conversation, which I'm not going to get into on this show.
Okay.
It was a great experience. I will say that. It was a great experience.
Oh, I bet it was. So
I just wish I could have done both.
Yeah. What was it about the documentary form that attracted you to it? What's special about the documentary form?
Well, I think what excited me right away was the opportunity to observe other people's lives and get them to tell their own stories in a way that would resonate for other people, and then constructing a story with, you know, working from real material. And then once the film is, that's really process oriented, but then once the film is made and out there, seeing how it can really affect people and really make a difference. It sounds cliche, but it's very true.
No, the documentaries more than anything else have that ability, I think. And we have a lot of amateur filmmakers that listen to the show, and quite a few people that are interested in documentaries. And from what you've learned over the years, what kind of advice would you give those filmmakers? What works for you that you found over the years?
Well, certainly study other filmmakers' work and see what kind of form of documentary interests you, and find your own voice within that. I think that's really what it comes down to as a filmmaker, is just finding your own authentic voice and how you want to express it. And then having a passion for what you want to say. Making a documentary, it usually takes years, so you really have to care about the subject to live with it for that long.
Yeah. Jerry, you were going to ask something?
Yeah, I wanted to know, what documentaries were you influenced by? What documentary filmmakers inspired you?
Well, early on, with The Times of Harvey Milk, I saw Barbara Kopple's film, the Harlan County, USA, in the, I guess it was like 76. And that film just blew me away, because it's about a coal mining strike.
It's a great film.
In Kentucky, yeah. And I was so taken by how a film, a documentary, could just take you into a whole other experience that you might otherwise not have any introduction to or connection with, and just you feel so emotionally invested in these people and what they're going through and their experience. And something about that film just really clicked for me, and I had that in mind all through the making of The Times of Harvey Milk. You know, if we could tell that story, which at that point people really didn't know anything about outside of San Francisco, in a way that it could connect for people anywhere who might see it and understand why it was, understand the emotional truth of that experience, then we would have succeeded. And I guess that's what I look for in documentaries, is some kind of emotional truth as well as intellectual truth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you mentioned that it's a commitment of years making these films, and that was certainly the case with The Times of Harvey Milk. I think, if I read correctly, you first got the notion to do this film when Proposition 6 was on the ballot. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. I started to make a film. I didn't get very far, but I certainly made the declaration that I was doing this film about the Briggs Initiative campaign, which was then the ballot initiative on the California ballot attempting to ban gay teachers. And 3 weeks after that election was when Harvey Milk was killed, which changed the course of history and the direction of my film as well.
Yeah.
And then it took 5 years, but But ultimately, those were five well-spent years in that it really allowed time to research and distill and figure out what was the essential part of the story that we wanted to tell.
And what was that for you? What did you find that was?
Well, it was really contextualizing Harvey so that that an audience could come to understand why he was a man of his times. And in order to for that to make sense, you had to be able to really characterize the times.
Yeah.
And the decision was to not do a biographical film, which is why the title is The Times of Harvey Milk and not The Life and Times of Harvey Milk. And to have his story told by fewer people rather than a survey of people, so that each person in the film would be a character in their own right, and each, in a way, represents an aspect of Harvey's legacy.
Yeah, I got to tell you, it is a gorgeous film. I just had an opportunity to see it recently, excuse me, and I was just absolutely blown away by it. But you do speak
and
to...
Was that the first time you saw it?
First time I've seen it.
I just asked out of curiosity because I would like to know, you know, it's 25 years later, you know, how does the film play for people now who either don't know the story or haven't seen it before, so I'm always interested here.
It's sad in one sense because it feels like history is repeats itself. So, you know, your film has the Milk, it just has a very, very urgency to it.
Yeah, these things are cyclical, but
yeah.
I guess that's how change takes hold.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but you spoke to the people that were quite close to him, and it wasn't too long, I would imagine, after the tragic events around his death. And I'm wondering, that must have been a very kind of raw process, and what that was like for you and how you approached them to participate in the project.
Well, interestingly, the filmed interviews were filmed in 83, so that was, you know, several years after, and it always impresses me when I still see the film how people have such access to the kind of rawness of their feelings. But that, you know, that also has to do with the process of filming. I think it adds a kind of intensity to people telling their own stories. But we did pre-interviews with about 75 to 100 people. So these were basically getting oral histories, which helped us to decide who we wanted to film and what parts of the story we felt had to be included.
Yeah.
So there was a long development period from when we started doing the research from when we actually filmed the final people in the film.
Yeah.
And for me personally, I guess, you know, I've said this before that doing a film, well, doing The Times of Harvey Milk, there was a certain catharsis in doing that film. You know, I lived in San Francisco during that time and went through those events. I was profoundly affected by them. Personally, the making of the film was part of that catharsis, I think.
Mm. What for you has been the most satisfying part of this journey with your film, The Tides of Harvey Milk?
Getting Harvey's story out there. That Harvey, you know, for all these years, Harvey's lived in the movie, and now, you know, he's represented in a whole other way by Milk, and it's going into, you know, venues that we never would have had the opportunity to in the multiplexes and all over, so it keeps reverberating. But
well, and it's certainly going to bring, it would be safe to say, it's going to bring more people to your film that were previously unaware of it or too young to view it upon its release.
I hope so. I mean, I hope so. People just have a physical sense of Harvey as well as the representative one by Sean Penn.
Yeah, I'm wondering that. How in your mind do these two projects complement one another?
Well, I think they do. I mean, I think there's also a lot of The Times of Harvey Milk in Milk, and I think they complement one another in that Milk, you get a lot more of the personal side of Harvey's story, which we don't tell in The Times of Harvey Milk.
Mm-hmm.
You get much more of what was going on behind the scenes for him in his personal life. So in that sense, I think they're complementary. In terms of what you get from the Times of Harvey Milk, aside from, you know, the documentary telling of the story and representation of Harvey himself, there's a whole third act to the story that's not in Milk, which is the Dan White trial and the aftermath.
The Twinkie defense, yeah.
The Twinkie defense.
Yeah,
I know, yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And the riots that happened after the verdict where he was convicted of manslaughter and sentenced to 5.5 years.
Tell me about the Gus Van Sant. I saw an interview with him. I believe it was Charlie Rose, and he spoke very highly of the Times of Harvey Milk. And I'm wondering to what extent did you two collaborate in the preparation phase of his film?
Well, I would say that the Times of Harvey Milk was foundational to Milk. I'll say that. And Gus is a friend, and I read the screenplay, and I gave some notes to that, and I gave them access to our archive, our documentary archive and our Carvel archive, and research tapes, pre-interviews. So James Franco, I know, was very pleased to get the pre-interview of Scott Smith because there really wasn't much other material on Scott.
Well, you had the only footage of him that he could study.
Yeah, I did. And I actually had pre-interviews with Cleve and Ann, and, well, Ann is in the Times of Harvey Milk and Cronenberg.
Now, did you yourself, for instance, the candlelight vigil that takes place after his death, did you yourself shoot that?
I did, and some of my shots are actually in Milk, some of the original shots that we filmed. Full disclosure, I was at the original march and was right up there. The shots that we filmed that are in the Times of Harvey Milk and in Milk, the shots that they used from our film, were filmed the year anniversary of the candlelight. So that year, a year after Milk and Moscone were killed, there was a 1 year anniversary march, and that's when we did our big shoot with four cameras for the march.
Tell me, this is a fun question. Tell me about the Oscar experience. You've won two of them, one for Harvey Milk. What was that like for you?
Well, it was the thrill of a lifetime.
I'm sure.
I have to say, as a young gay boy growing up, I watched the Oscars every year. Never in my life did I ever imagine that I would be on the other side of it.
Right, right.
Let alone now I'm on the board of the Academy. So, you know, you never know where life is going to take you when you're a kid watching television and what fantasies may come true. But it was just such a wonderful, wonderful high. And for that time, 1984, for that film to be embraced by Hollywood, that was a big deal because there was nothing, you know, Hollywood wasn't making gay movies, gay-themed movies or gay characters, and there was nothing on television. So this was a big step for Hollywood to take, and there was, I would say, just a full sense of celebration around that when the film won, for which I'm forever grateful.
And you actually covered Hollywood's treatment of homosexuality in another one of your films, The Celluloid Closet. And I'm wondering, it's been, I think that came out in 95, 96?
Right, 95.
And since then, obviously, we've seen several gay films, some of which have really caught on with the public in a way. Not only Milk, which it's doing now, but of course Brokeback Mountain prior to that. Do you see a shift change where you know, America out there is embracing these films more and more?
I think so. You know, I think, well, certainly Brokeback Mountain was a huge title shift. In terms of Hollywood and the production of these films, it all comes down to economics. So there has to be the box office for those films to continue to get made for anyone to want to finance them. But in terms of audiences, I think audiences are much more mature and sophisticated about the subject, and that's just only going to continue to change and evolve.
And I understand as well that you're working on your first feature film. I think it's called Howl.
That's right.
Tell me about that project. That's exciting.
Yes, it's based on the poem written by Allen Ginsberg in 1955 of the same name, which was a groundbreaking poem in terms of its language and its imagery and its content, and really helped launch the whole Beat literary movement. And when the poem came out, it was deemed obscene, and there was an obscenity trial in 1957. Against the publisher of the poem. So our film really tells the story of the obscenity trial and the poem using animation and the narrative thread of the film is the trial itself. And James Franco will be playing young Allen Ginsberg in the movie.
Oh, that's great. that's an exciting project. Are you a couple of months out from starting that?
We hope to be shooting the end of February, begin shooting in late February, early March.
Mm. Just have just a couple of more quick questions for you, and then we'll let you go. What do you hope that people take from your film and from Mr. Van Sant's film from Harvey's life, from Harvey's crusade?
Couple of things come to mind immediately. One is the need for everyone, for all of us. I mean, I think this is the universal message that we all have to be involved in our communities, however we define community, because that's how things happen and that's how change gets made, be it electing a gay politician for the first time or an African-American president or ending a war or fighting a discriminatory constitutional amendment. You know, it's through community engagement that we can really make things happen and hopefully for the greater good. Mm-hmm. And I think for gay people, it's to just be honest, you know, to be honest about who we are. And it's a lot harder, I think, for people to be discriminatory against those that they know and love. And that's what Harvey's message was about then, at that point in history, in 1978. And I think that still holds true.
Oh, we still need that message now.
Yeah, so. We do.
Do you see an heir to Harvey out there, whether it's on the political horizon or somewhere else?
Well, I think there are multiple heirs. I think, you know, I think that in communities all over the country there are people doing work on a local level and state level. I don't think there's anyone that looks like they're going to be a breakout star in the way that Harvey might have been, in the way that Obama is. And I think, you know, we always hope and look for that. But by the same token, you never know where it's going to come from. You know, who knew where Barack Obama was going to come from 3 years ago?
That's absolutely right.
You know, they're out there.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Epstein, thank you so much. And I love your film. I appreciate your time very much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Okay, that was Rob Epstein, the director of The Times of Harvey Milk. And the movie's getting a lot of attention now, 25 years after it was initially released and won the Oscar, because obviously, Gus Van Sant's movie's out there now. So
right. Mm-hmm.
Getting major Oscar buzz, and you say for a very good reason, Jerry, because you've seen it.
Yeah. Well, that shouldn't be the reason, because I've seen it. We don't.
Well,
Never mind, because I was about to say. But, no, it is very good, and I do think acting-wise, it is the front-runner, I think. It looks like it's a three-way race. Sean, Clint, and Mickey. Right now, I could be totally off base, but I do think it's at least between Sean and Mickey, if anybody.
Yeah.
But it's not just Sean Penn's performance is astounding. But Also, James Franco is very good, and this has been an excellent year for him because, given, as he has said in an interview in GQ, the two movies he is most proud of are The Pineapple Express and Milk.
Yeah.
He's very hard on some of his other films. He says, you know, you do all this preparation work for some of these other films, and they come out around the same time. You go see them, and you're like, well, what did I waste my time doing?
Right.
What was I doing, you know, for some of these films? I'm not going to name them. He did, but I'm not. But he's like, you watch the finished product, and you're just like, what is this? So it's very nice to hear him talk about how proud he is of these two films, and he should be. They're both very good films. But I do think Milk is the front runner. I think that's going to be the Oscar front runner right now. It won the New York Film Critics on Best Picture, I think, today or yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been snatching up some early awards, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of, I mean, it's very, obviously very topical, but it's also the kind of rousing, kind of biographical film. That,
very emotional. And
yeah.
It's not the standard biopic, because some biopics make the mistake of start doing the whole life.
Right, right.
And that doesn't make for a good film. Get it when their lives, you know, why are we interested in this person? And that's what Milk does very well, like Lawrence of Arabia, for that matter. I mean, if Lawrence of Arabia covered his whole life, you know, there's a reason why it starts where it does. I mean, that's because, and that's the same with Milk. That's where the interest is. That's where the intensity is. And Gus Van Sant does an excellent job.
Yeah. And meanwhile, The Times of Harvey Milk, it's available on DVD and video on demand.
Mm-hmm.
Look it up, find it. It's well worth your time. And as Mr. Epstein attested to, there's a lot of material in there that you're not going to get from the film.
Right.
So they are very good companion pieces, and it is truly one of our great and important documentaries. And he's a great filmmaker. So I'm excited to see what he does with this narrative feature.
Oh yeah, that's inspiring casting. Franco as Ginsburg. That's really cool. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, me too. What's out this weekend? You're going to see Frost Nixon? Is that what you're going to do?
I'm going to try. It's only playing. It's really weird the way they're doing this. It's not a wide release this weekend. It's only going to be at one theater. So I'm going to try to see that. If not that, I'll try to see Doubt.
Right. No doubt.
And I will probably, worst, you go see The Day the Earth Stood Still, so expect that two-sentence or three-sentence review Sunday.
I'll await it with bated breath.
I'm sure you'll probably hang up on me.
Yeah, Frost Nixon, that opens wide on Christmas Day, I think. It's one of the Christmas Day movies.
Ooh, this is I don't know, this tactic of releasing so many films, this platform thing, and then going wide on Christmas, where you have already several wide releases, it's
right.
Too much. And they do this every year, and it backfires horribly.
Yeah, but you know, it's like the holidays. It's like holiday movies when they open, like Bolt, when it opened pre-Thanksgiving, and it has the benefit of enjoying two holidays. Really, for movies like Milk and Frost Nixon and all of those, the award season kind of acts as their own holidays in a way.
Yeah.
Those films.
Yeah, no, it does. And I mean, that's why you do what you do. You either do it to two, you know, play for a week in December and then you open wide in January, which I know some of the, like Defiance, I think, is doing that. Nothing But the Truth is doing that. So, yeah, I mean, it's more, I think, the critical. They're all going for the Oscar. So they're really aiming for that. They want to get in before the end of the nominations.
Right.
So we'll see what happens. You know, I mean, so there'll be a lot to see this Christmas.
Yeah, I think so too. Our next guest, they showed up here on the line, and then their call disappeared. So we'll wait for them to call us back.
Yeah, well, they probably heard my voice and hung up.
They were probably scared to death. Yeah.
I would hang up. I mean, when I hear my voice, I want to hang up the phone. So.
Yeah. So, you know, I haven't, I get a lot of films mailed to me. I haven't been out to see many lately. I've been meaning to. I've been wanting to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with my weekend free time, I watch movies at home and I watch football.
Well, those are very important things, you know. Now, what films have you, can you let us know what films you've been watching at home?
I have not seen. I have not watched Wendy and Lucy yet.
Okay.
I have that here, and I haven't watched it yet. I did rewatch Dear Zachary, and Man on Wire. I got that in, and I was going to rewatch that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I've been checking out some things I checked out in the theater. I watched Hancock again.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you watched it again? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
How is it a second time?
It was just the same as the first.
Okay. Okay. I fair enough.
An ambitious movie that just somehow misses the mark.
Yeah. Absolutely right.
Short. Yeah. And I was watching it with rabid Will Smith fans. But the question is The Dark Knight. I cannot wait to see those sales, those DVD sales. I'm sure it's going to break records. It came out yesterday.
I'm sure it will.
Yeah, did you pick it up yesterday?
I ordered it on Blu-ray, but still don't have a Blu-ray player. Folks, there's a lesson here. No, I am actually getting a Blu-ray player for Christmas. I'm going ahead and get, I think, a Sony Blu-ray player. Not the PS3, but just a regular standalone Blu-ray player.
Right.
So but don't buy the Blu-rays before you get the machine. This backfired horribly.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's sitting there, and all you can do is stare at it and just and kind of dream. Do you serenade to it?
No, I just go. I think I'm just going to go. My friend of mine at work has a Blu-ray player and a nice like flat screen. I might just go bring it in there and watch it. You know.
Yeah, I'm typing to the publicist. Fill the time.
Okay. No. So I'm trying to think. Have you watched Man on the Wire again, or?
No, it's a film that I really liked, though.
It's definitely a front runner for me for documentary this year.
Right.
Definitely.
So the Golden Globe noms tomorrow, and honestly, you know, Man on Wire's up there for that category. What I'm surprised is I don't know why Religious seems almost automatically disqualified.
I don't get that at all. I liked it a lot. I thought it was very good.
If for no other reason, it's the biggest grossing documentary of the year.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you. I have no idea why that's not getting any love whatsoever.
What gives? What gives, man? That's all I got to
say. I don't know. I honestly just don't know. But I think the other thing to look out for tomorrow, and the way, you know, our friend Garney, over at his blog on MySpace, that gave his predictions for the Golden Globes. And he seems to think that W, as this wild card, will show up in comedy and musical.
Right. Well, it could in the Golden Globes.
Because are they, as like a, I guess they're looking at a satire.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, Nicholas. Nicholas has brought up a couple of good points, which is very unusual for Nicholas. But
dude, Nicholas is one of our hardcore fans,
I love Nicholas. I just had to make a joke, you know, Mr. Sarcasm. First of all, he said, since we're on the documentary subject, he talks about American Teen wasn't on the list either. And
that's surprising.
Yeah, that was a claim this year.
Mm-hmm.
And then about The Day the Earth Stood Still, he seems to think that fans of the 1951 classic will be upset by this. How many of those are there?
I think they already are.
Yeah. And how many of those are there? I mean, are there Davy Erstis still loyalists out there?
Well, they're not loyalists, but they're people like myself who respect the film and just don't understand why this remake. I don't know. I mean, the trailer doesn't even make sense. What is it? If you die, the planet dies. If the planet, you know, it's just like, what kind of mumbo-jumbo is that?
Yeah. I do like the idea of Keanu Reeves playing an alien.
Yeah. My buddy, you know, a lot of people will say he's the most wooden actor of his generation.
I mean, it's
I don't
basically
know.
What he it's basically what he played in Sweet November. I happen to like Keanu Reeves.
I like him. He gets a lot of. I actually liked him in that one with Diane Keaton and Jack Nicholson.
Oh,
something's
yeah.
got to
give. He's gotten a lot better, and he's made some good choices lately. But I like him because he's always reaching outside his comfort zone. If you think about doing Shakespeare, didn't he do like a Kenneth Branagh Shakespeare?
Didn't he do the Much Ado About Nothing? Wasn't that the one?
Yeah.
Early on, he was really, he did a lot of good stuff. And I mean, I don't know, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure is very funny, but I was talking about River's Edge, and My Own Private Idaho, I Love You to Death, Parenthood. He was, you know, he gets his bad rap, but actually, if you really think about it, he has made some pretty good movies.
Well, he's hysterical in I Love You to Death. He and William
teamed
up.
Yeah, he and River Phoenix. I missed that partnership.
Yeah, yeah. Tell me what you think I should do for this guest. The publicist asked me to call her if there were, was any problem.
Mm-hmm.
Should I call her in the middle of the show here?
Yeah, you should call her. I don't think you should do it on the air, but yeah, you should call her.
Well, I'm on the air. What choice do I have?
Oh my God!
Well, let's take a poll. Everyone out there in the chat room, would you like to hear me call and see about our guest? You know, this is a democracy here. I want the listeners to participate.
Well, I'm waiting for a response. Let's see if anybody.
Yeah, they're probably on a time delay, so we'll probably get an answer in another 10, 15 minutes when it's too late. They're talking about Lawrence Kasdan being...
Great, how did Lawrence Kasdan get into the conversation?
Do you think I should call the publicist? Yeah, I think Lawrence Kasdan is a god of filmmaking.
Okay, Nicholas says, call... The Rub says go, and... All right, you call.
All right, would you like a little musical interlude, or do you feel comfortable filling the time until...
I'm going to fill in the interlude. I'm going to talk. I'm going to talk more about the Day of the Earth. So we're going to have one of these roaming, like, weird, surreal, talking to the chat room on the air kind of thing.
Right. Okay.
Right, yeah, I just knew you'd be excited about that. No, but my thoughts on the Day of the Earth Stood Still. Now, I haven't seen the film yet. It's a weird, the trailer is interesting. Does anyone have sound? That's Tim. You're making me nervous. Very nervous. Tim does not have sound. Oh my. No, I don't know if we needed a remake of the Day of the Earth Stood Still. I think the reason, and I'm probably wrong about this, they wanted to remake it is because of they thought we were living, and we do live in turbulent times, there's no doubt about that. And this one seems to be very ecologically themed, to do with the environment, so it is very timely. Whether it will work or not, I really don't have any idea. And if anyone in the chat room wants to call in, to actually call in and talk to us, that would be really cool. And I know you all really want to call in. But you're all talking about sound and refreshing. Oh, my God. Yeah, refresh. That's if you don't have sound, you just want to do that. Okay. So the other films that come out this weekend are Nothing Like the Holidays, which looks like it could be pretty funny. I guess like Four Christmases. That could be good. I probably won't get a chance to see it this weekend, but I'm sure many of you want to go see it. So, you know, give us a call back next week and tell us what you thought of it. The other films that we have a limited release on, Frost Nixon, as we were talking about earlier. And, you know, I feel like James Dean at the end of Giant just rambling on when he's drunk and no one's listening to him and he's all alone. I feel like that right now. Nick, call in, please.
Hang on. Oh, we have something interesting, Jerry. I don't know what
you're
saying. Okay, cool. But is this Kitten Fist?
Yeah, hell yeah, this is Kitten Fist.
Oh, baby, Kitten Fist. Hell yeah.
How you doing, man?
Guy?
I hope I didn't offend you, you know, by just rambling on like that.
Oh, no, not at all. Are you kidding me? I'm used to it, Jerry.
Okay, yeah.
Do you know what's happening, Chris?
I just came in about 5 minutes ago, so I got an idea about what's going on here, but you know, hey, that's what happens when you're doing live radio, you know, sometimes.
Anything can happen.
Up. Yeah, it's live.
Yes. Are you excited about the Golden Globe noms tomorrow? I know how you get. Giddy as a kid on Christmas.
Well, you know, Golden Globes are, you know, like, they're just not quite the Oscars. But, yeah, I get excited. Yeah, of course. You know, because it's kind of it's a precursor. And also, you get to see some nominations that you probably won't get to see. You know, those lesser, you know, you can expect to see somebody like Robert Downey Jr. get a nomination for Best Performance maybe at the Golden Globes, where maybe you won't see that at the Oscars, you know.
Right.
But it maybe it'll be recognized. Those performances that just aren't quite on that level, but they were really good, they get
right.
recognized at the Golden Globes. So that's kind of cool, actually, you know.
Yeah, I think so, too. You know, the funniest thing happened, Chris. As you called in, I got two other calls on my phone. You just inspire everyone to want to participate.
Yeah,
Kitten Fist showed up. You know, Kitten Fist brings the noise when he comes, you know.
Kitten Fist loves Back by Midnight.
That's right.
Let me pick this up real quick. I have a 515. This is Iowa.
This is Iowa. This is the Rub. This is Jeremy.
Hey, what's up?
How are you?
Hey, Rub. How are you, man?
Very good to talk to you.
It is good. It's nice to talk to you guys finally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Cool.
What's going on?
Nothing. There was a lot of dead air, so I thought I'd call in and.
Thank you. Thank you for saving us.
Dead air or Jerry was just going on and on? Do you equate those as the same thing? Or?
It was pretty much the same, but it didn't matter.
Thanks, Jeremy. Thank you so much.
No problem.
So tell me, before I pick up this other line, which could be our guest, I don't recognize the number, but it could be, what movie are you most looking forward to, man, this season?
I'd probably have to say The Wrestler.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not coming anywhere near me until January, I think. That and Slumdog Millionaire, probably. There's really not a lot of stuff that's been out that seems like there's enough movies to fill a good top 10 list, you know?
I know what you're saying, yeah.
Chris, you and I actually, we talked about Slumdog last night and how that's one of the sleeper movies that I've snuck up.
Right. It is. It's one of those sleeper movies that's come out at the end of the year, out of nowhere, kind of like the way Juno did last year. Obviously, they're two different kinds of movies, but they just sort of show up out of nowhere, and everybody's talking about it all of a sudden, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Rub, appreciate you calling in, buddy, and
yeah,
it's good to hear your voice.
Finally.
Not a problem. I'll see if I can make it a more regular appearance.
I appreciate it, Rob. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Not a problem.
Bye-bye, man.
Bye-bye.
Chris, do you want to hold on for our guest, if this happens to be our guest?
Yeah, I'll hold on. Yeah.
Go, hold on.
What was that? That sounded very, like, uncommitted.
Nah, I'm not going anywhere. I'll hold on, yeah.
All right, dude. All right. I'm going to read this intro. And it could be a complete embarrassment if this isn't our guest.
Could
but
be.
I've...
Wait, it's Nicholas Vargo. Don't bother. It's Nicholas Vargo. He's on hold.
Are you kidding me? Did he
say
that?
That's what he said. He says it, and look in the chat room.
Nicholas, is this you?
It is.
Oh, you tease.
Yeah. This is just like...
What's up, Nicholas?
I'm doing all right. Jeez, I'm just laughing now. I don't know why.
was my rambling on that bad? I mean, we didn't lose any listeners, but I mean, everyone's still in the chat room. But I mean, Tim Price couldn't hear anything. But
well, they're still in the chat room because it's pretty hard to log off when you're sleeping.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jamie.
That was funny, Chris. Wasn't that funny? That was good.
That's pretty funny.
Nicholas, what's going on? Are you calling to extol on and on about Slumdog tonight?
No. but good guess, though.
I thought it was about a hot dog stand in a poverty-stricken neighborhood when I first heard Slumdog Millionaire. That's what I thought it was about. Yeah. No, I'm actually just joking. It's about, like, who wants to be a millionaire or something. What is it?
Yeah, it's who wants to be a millionaire, like, in India. And it's, like, a very, like, it's like Oliver Twist, you could say, for the 21st century. In
who can resist
Barry
that?
Barry Dickens.
Yeah.
Yeah, he got right.
Yeah. And you liked it, Nicholas, why?
I went in there not really knowing much about it at all. I mean, I barely had glimpsed the trailer before I went in to see it. And when I sat down and watched it, I didn't know what to expect, really. And once the movie was over, I was just won over by it, to be perfectly honest. I had no idea what to expect. I just sat there and watched the film unfold in front of me. And actually, I enjoyed it, I think, a little bit more on this, my second viewing, knowing what to expect on that second viewing more than the first, actually. Once that second viewing ended, I was like, I was madly in love with it for good.
Yeah. Isn't that great? Like, when you walk into a movie, and it so rarely happens, and you don't know anything about it. I mean, Chris and I have talked about it, too. Like, it's always a special treat. And I remember one night, Chris, were you with me? We went to see Playing by Heart or something. Were you there with me that night?
Yes, I was.
We just saw the poster, and we were like, I've never even heard of this movie. And we walked in, and we enjoyed it, probably more so than if we had been befuddled with promotion beforehand.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of those were up-and-comers in that movie. I mean, there were people, you know, like Ryan Phillippe and Angelina Jolie, people who at the time were basically nobodies, you know, and that's what could be going on with Slumdog Millionaire. We could be seeing some of these guys and girls in movies in the next couple of years.
Yeah.
So it's exciting when a little movie like this comes out. Obviously, Danny Boyle is, you know, he's
no slouch.
Slouch. He's had plenty of good movies, but it's a cast of basically nobodies among Americans. You know, that's exciting. That's really cool. We get introduced to these new actors who, by all accounts, are really, really talented. So
yeah,
that's very
well,
cool.
You know, you guys make an interesting point, though, because Danny Boyle's are two triumphs, in my opinion, Trainspotting and Sunshine. They essentially have unknowns in it. I mean, Trainspotting, you know, nobody knew who Ewan McGregor was when that movie came out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, not just Ewan McGregor, but lots of other little, you know, good actors.
Robert Carlyle.
Or, you know, what's her name, Kelly McDonald, is that her name, who was in No Country last year, or Johnny Lee Miller, who was basically not a well-known actor at the time, and now he's gone on to do some interesting stuff. He's got this talent, or how about the little boy in Millions, who I don't know, I know he made another movie last year that was not well-received, but that little actor is pretty astounding, and that's a nice little movie.
Right, it is.
Danny Boyle finally getting some recognition, and I hope he's mentioned in those five names at the end of the year. I haven't seen this movie, but I have not heard anything bad about it. I've not heard anything negative.
You know, and for the past few years, there have always been, in those top five films, the feel-good sleeper.
Right.
I mean, you look at Little Miss Sunshine. You look at, what was last year?
Juno.
Yeah, this is Slumdog is that movie this year.
Yeah, and those movies, you know, once in a blue moon, those movies like Shakespeare in Love, say what you want about it, maybe it deserved to win, maybe it didn't, but once in a blue moon, those movies win, because for one reason or another, it really just captures people's imagination, captures people's entertainment. It's the one thing, you know, when everything else... The Oscars, typically, the five movies at the end of the year, you know, they're good. They're always great, but they're a little bit down sometimes, you know.
Right.
So and
this could be the one that changed the tide.
Right, a little bit happy. People want, especially right now, there's a lot of crap going on in the world. People want something that's a little bit more uplifting, you know.
You're absolutely right.
And as brutal as some of Slumdog Millionaire is, you know, it is a really uplifting movie. I mean, when the movie ends, you're like walking on air when you leave that theater.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's unusual these days. How many times you walk out of plenty of movies? We all walked out of No Country for Old Men blown away. We all walked out of The Departed blown away. We all walked out of There Will Be Blood blown away. But you're not energized like that. You're not
exactly.
Right. You don't have that feeling like, wow, you know, I mean, you just feel good about yourself. That rarely happens, and it should be recognized, no?
I think that'll happen to me after I watched Doubt.
I've heard nothing good about Doubt so far, so.
Well, a lot of doubt out there for Doubt.
No. I've got a friend who's already seen it before it even came out, and he said it was great.
There was no doubt
in
his mind.
I read that the New Yorker review was short and mean. And the New Yorker review for the Reader wasn't much better.
The critic for New York was for New York Times was probably short and mean, too.
I was talking about the New Yorker. The New York Times wasn't crazy about the Reader either, though. Both of these high-profile films not getting, like, the buzz that everyone thought.
But it's not just those two high-profile films. Is it me, or have there been just a succession of movies this year that seemed like they were Oscar contenders, that either got released to little or bad buzz or got postponed. This year, all those movies that we thought, you know, back 3, 4, 5 months ago were going to be Oscar contenders. Basically, if you put that list together 5 months ago, it would be completely different than the list you would put together today.
The two that really, you know, obviously the postponing of The Road and The Soloist.
Yes.
And I don't know what was wrong with The Road. I don't know what was wrong with either of them, but they just decided to take them out. And there are a lot of disappointments, you could say, in the early part of the fall season that you thought, hey, these would be surefire things, and they just fizzled.
Right, or movies like Defiance, Role Models,
Changeling.
Things like that.
Changeling is another one.
Changeling and Body of Lies, you know, both underperformed critically and commercially. So,
which is what leads me to believe, and I've told Jamie this in the last couple weeks, that I think this year is going to shape up to be the year of the studio picture. I really think it's going to be obviously. We're going to have maybe some recognition for smaller films like Slumdog Millionaire and The Wrestler, but there's these movies that are on the cusp that I think are going to get a lot of push at the end of the year. Movies like The Dark Knight, like WALL-E, that
I think
really
those two
are
for
deserve
sure.
to they deserve to be in the conversation right now
they
because
do.
When you look back at the good times you've had at the movies this year, it's hard to deny that those two movies in particular, among others, like Iron Man and things like that. I'm not saying Iron Man is going to get a Best Picture nod, but you've had really good times this year at studio pictures, which is good.
Yeah, I agree.
I think that's great.
Yeah. And it is the year of the comeback, too. I read an article about it, and Downey Jr. and Mickey Rourke are the poster boys for that this year.
You're right.
Speaking of comebacks, Jerry and I were talking about something before the show started. We have about 3 minutes before our next guest calls in. Hopefully they'll call in and stay there. We're talking about not has-beens, but people who have disappeared. And one of them is – I'll go through a couple of names – one of them, remember Little Voice, whatever happened to the performance in Little Voice that everyone said was so astounding, and it was.
Jane Horak.
That lead actress there.
She still does absolutely fabulous when they have specials. She comes on as Bubble, but I have not seen her in a movie in a long time.
Yeah. And what's that?
Who's the actress?
Jane Horak.
She's done voiceover work for Corpse Bride, actually.
Well, what more do you need?
Yeah, really.
And then Madeline Stowe. We were talking about Madeline Stowe earlier, too. And our next guest, I believe, is on the line, and we'll pick up that line and start that interview. Madeline Stowe, where'd she go?
No.
Madeline
Stowe,
where'd
away.
She go? She just... Jerry, I
you
miss
were...
her. She did a lot of great movies in the 90s.
She did. You know, We Were Soldiers Part 2. I guess she's waiting for that.
Oh, I hope. I hope not, because
I hope
I'd like
not.
To see her before that happens. Anyway, Nicholas, buddy, thank you so much for calling in, man.
No problem. One more thing before you let me out of here. I just want to say one thing about The Wrestler. I mean, I think Mickey Rourke's going to get the nomination for Best Actor, but the rest of the movie, I have not heard any real good positive things coming from it, though, to be honest. Only Mickey Rourke is the only real positive thing I'm hearing.
Gleiberman just gave it an A.
It's
got 100% on Rotten Tomatoes right now.
Yeah.
But I did read one. I will agree with you that I did read one little piece in Time magazine, which did not have a lot of great things to say about it. So it's not going to stay 100%. But right now, it does have pretty good reviews. There's about 20-25 reviews on there.
I did hear, though, about an Academy screening where 100 people walked out within the first half hour, though.
But I think you're right, Nicholas, in the comparison that you make. It could be this year's last King of Scotland, where you didn't hear a lot about the film, even though I like that film. But Forest Whitaker dominated the praise in relation to
absolutely.
That film and won the award for it. Nicholas, your cell phone connection is really bad. I don't know if you're calling from a submarine or something, but we appreciate you calling in.
Yeah, thank you, Nicholas. And I think the reason they walked out was because of Sid Gannis's B.O. I don't think it had anything to do with the movie. I think it was just Sid Gannis's B.O., but all right.
Thank you. Thank you, Jerry. Thank you.
Yeah, anything, whatever I can do to liven up, you know.
Let's get to our guest tonight, We're really excited to speak to this gentleman. Let me name some of these. Play It to the Bone, Hollywood Homicide, Criminal, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, Talladega Nights, The Nines, and this season's Four Christmases and What Doesn't Kill You. These are just a few of the stunning credits of our next guest, composer Alex Werman. He is a two-time winner of the BMI Film Music Award, and he was nominated for an Emmy for his extraordinary work in another great film, Bernard and Doris. And we are honored to welcome him to the show. Alex, are you with us?
I am. For a moment there, I was hoping that you were going to say my name. It feels weird. Like, yeah, we have our next guest, and I was just hoping it was me, actually.
It is you. You are the chosen
well,
one.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to hear you guys.
Thank you very much. Tell me, I read that your parents were both musical. So
yeah.
Was that what initially rubbed off on you and made you pursue music? Were they of particular inspiration to you?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I have three siblings that are all 8 years and older than me, and they're all musicians. So when I came out, there was already a band playing. Mm. And so I think another interesting thing about my family is that my father comes from a long line of musicians. He grew up in Vienna, Austria. And my mother was, you know, sort of very street smart. She was in London. She grew up in London, and she had to work very hard to become one of the first musicians in her family.
Right.
So the two philosophies, nature and nurture, were very prevalent, you know, in contrast to each other.
Yeah. And what was that first instrument that you started playing and really connected with?
The piano. It was readily accessible. It was always sitting there.
Yeah. What music were you interested in at first? What style?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. Well, at first, it was all the little doodles that I was doing. My mother said that I was doodling all the time. But we started molding that into something a little more structured. So I was practicing Hannon, Clementi. My mother was a Suzuki violin teacher, so she was convinced that everybody could play if they were taught and learning with their ears. So I did a lot of that too. But my brother played on the Chase the Clouds Away record of Chuck Mangione. So I started
cool.
getting into the jazz thing pretty early too.
A lot of film composers I find do have a jazz background. Is that particularly useful for the film composer in some way?
I think it is because jazz is very largely based on spontaneity. And spontaneity, gives you, to be able to be spontaneous, you have to round up a bunch of skills that are good with regards to film composition and allowing you to be diverse. One of the movies you forgot to mention was Anchorman.
Right.
And that one required a lot of diversity and spontaneity.
Mm.
So, yeah, jazz helps.
When you're interested in music, you're a musician, when does the film scoring come into play for you? When did that become a possibility for you?
When I was coming up, I had no clue, but when I looked back at it, it was Star Wars. It just killed me. It was so extremely inspiring. You know, I was only 9 or something, and, you know, John Williams writes this fantastic music, and the script of the opening scene is going up into the sky, and the camera pans up into the sky, and what he wrote was this, you know, this beautiful mode of harmony that escalates us up into outer space, and I'll never forget that feeling. I knew I was in outer space in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so that really got me. You remember that?
I remember the first time. It was the first time I waited so long in line to get into a movie. Went around the block and everything. Just a surreal experience for a 6-year-old.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. And now, you mentioned Williams and Star Wars. Were there other composers that were an influence to you?
I think still my favorite movie of all time is Breaking Away.
Huh.
So Patrick Williams did an adaptation of a lot of music of Felix Mendelssohn and Rossini, and so I think just hearing great music in film was a great thing. When I started studying film composition, I was in my early 20s, James Newton Howard was one of the first.
Yeah.
I saw the movie Grand Canyon, and I was really struck by that film. And then I saw Bugsy, and I started checking out Ennio Morricone, and then I saw The Mission, and oh my gosh, from that point, it was, I almost quit.
Well, I mean, it doesn't come more haunting than a Morricone score.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
That's absolutely incredible. So where did you study, and how did you get that first big break?
Oh boy. Well, you know, I kept getting kicked out of all the schools, including the high schools I was going to. I got kicked out of I got a scholarship to the University of Miami in the jazz program there. That was taken away from me because I failed my jazz piano class. I'd spent time writing music for the ensembles, but I'd never actually, I didn't want to transcribe Herbie Hancock solos, so I lost my scholarship.
Right.
But how did I get my first big break? Well, my first break came in the, you know, my first film came from an engineer that I was working with. He met a guy who wanted to do all the post-production and all this, you know, this very low-budget approach to filmmaking. And the music supervisor, post-production supervisor, same guy, gave me all the necessary equipment to sync up to the movie. And I did it for $3,000. I think he got about $8,000 out of it, you know, for the score part of it.
Right.
But I learned at least that much worth. And then I met Ron Shelton, you know, I worked with Zimmer for a little while, and he was educating me along the way. And I met Percy Adlon, who directed Baghdad Cafe. Percy Adlon he made a movie with Lolita Davidovich, and she was married to Ron Shelton, and Ron Shelton and I met, and then Ron Shelton used me for Play to the Bone.
And several of his films, and I'm wondering what that collaboration was like between the two of you.
Yeah, he's a great dude. He championed me along the way, and he taught me a lot of lessons, you know. Things like don't be an overachiever is the first thing I learned from him. And then there was one little moment we had that I've reflected on in different ways over the years. I wanted to do a thing where I had a slide guitar and a trombone playing the melody
together
because they both slide.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said to him, hey, so it's going to be really cool. It's going to be like a slide guitar and a trombone. He goes, trombone? And I immediately reacted, and I said, well, you know, the trombone's going to be really soft. And he's like, barely be able to hear it. He said, well, if you can't hear it, why are you going to pay the guy?
Yeah, exactly. But you have composed several different kinds of genres. I mean, that's the name of the game. And I'm wondering about how you approach these pieces, these films. Do you approach them first as kind of a storyteller to get a sense of what the film is?
Well, now that I'm old enough to know what the story is, yeah. At first, I was just trying to come up with a groove and a sound that I thought felt right for the movie. Now I'm mature enough to actually take it at its heart first. And I've got enough tricks in my bag that the sound kind of comes out much more naturally. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think story is, I mean, that's why I think film composition is a great career to have, because, you know, the older you are, the wiser you are, the more poignant your messages can become.
Right. Well, that's true. That's true of all artists, I think, that grow.
Yeah, that's
all
true.
Artists in general. Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And in terms of your collaborations with your directors, what kind of dialogue do you enjoy most between the two of you? Are your directors generally very hands-on and musical-oriented? Do you appreciate that about them?
I do appreciate the musical knowledge I get from directors. They have all given me some knowledge about a genre or an application of music that I hadn't thought of before. I think what I enjoy the most is that moment when they've tried their darndest to express themselves to you, and I encourage them always not to use musical dialogue if it doesn't behoove them. But that moment where you take something that was so subjective and you turn it into a sound that appeals to them, that's so gratifying. So, but it comes in all different ways, you know.
Yeah. What should, in your mind, what should a film score do?
Well, I think it should definitely not mimic what's on the screen. It should it should help illustrate the backstory or the character of the film that isn't necessarily on the surface of things.
Mm-hmm.
Try and tell the part of the story that can't be told in any other way, really.
Right.
Yeah, and, you know, if there's a big role in a movie for music, that's great. If it's really small, I think it's very important that the music doesn't get in the way. That, you know,
yeah.
it can be a palette. It can help you clear your palette and move you from one section to another without stealing any attention or trying to add something that doesn't need to be added.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of Four Christmases, what was the goal there? What were you trying to accomplish with that film?
Gosh.
Are the
got
challenges? Yeah, the challenges of working on that film and the whole experience of it.
Well, it was a challenging film in that we tried a whole bunch of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Vince and Reese are both perfectly fine without any musical accompaniment to enhance their comedy or even their story.
Yeah,
we had to move it up into a more animated place to make it a little bit more mainstream. Because it's hard to palate a dry movie. You know, people want to go out and see a holiday movie. So we had to find that balance where we were giving them a holiday movie, but also, you know, Vince's comedy is very edgy, and, you know, they were working on the balance of how edgy his comedy would be in that film so that they could have a film that would appeal to the right, you know, so that wouldn't shock people that wanted to go out and see a Christmas movie, and it wouldn't bore people that want to go out and see Vince Vaughn.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
what
with music.
What kind of instruments did you hear in your mind whenever you first screened portions of the film?
Well, we tried a bunch of stuff. We tried the swingle singers.
Uh-huh.
I was thinking about a bell choir. We tried some white gospel music from the 50s. We tried a lot of stuff. We ended up in a much more mainstream way because it just seemed that everything else was a bit too affected.
Right.
And it was nice to just rest on. In fact, you know, I just thought that Vince and Reese did so well together on screen. And it reminded me of those great sort of romantic comedy duos of the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
And I wanted to try and bring that back. I was feeling Mancini and Gershwin and Bernstein, and I just thought that big Christmassy feel was really nice for this film.
Yeah. Do you do that often? Do you kind of recall previous scores in similar genres to get a sense of what you might be looking for?
Well, I do like that sense of sentimentality and reminiscence. So, you know, if music is part of what brings that stuff up in you, then yeah, I do that. I sometimes just consider myself a liaison, you know, with the Four Christmases particularly. I was basically a liaison between the style that we're familiar with and this film. You know, I didn't feel the need to really invent a whole lot that was new. I would love to talk a bit about this other film, What Doesn't Kill You, which is coming out this Friday.
I do, and this is a very different, and we just spoke to the producer of this film today, Rod Laurie, I believe is the producer on the film. And this seems like a great movie. It's getting excellent reviews, and it's a completely different project than Four Christmases, I would imagine.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about this one.
Brian Goodman, the director, is the subject of the story. He lived the life that the story was about. He grew up in South Boston, didn't have much of a stable family, and made a friend and resorted to petty crime for a way of life. And it, you know, it goes in a direction that, you know, is unfortunate. But he was so strong that he brought himself out of it. He picked himself up and got himself out of this situation. And he's been fortunate enough to meet the right people and figure out a way to actually put this story on film. And he's done a great job of it. And so working with him was intense because I felt the responsibility to to not only write a good theme for his movie and to paint the picture and to facilitate the colors of his film with music, but to also do one, to write a theme that would not offend the story of his life, you know. And so when I sat there with him and played the piano and showed him his main theme, it was definitely a highlight of my career, for sure.
Mm. Mm. What was his reaction to that score?
He shed some tears in that moment. I've heard that's not hard to do with him. I would think that, you know, somebody in his position would be easy to make him cry, because he feels so incredibly fortunate to have saved his situation so well.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, it was still be something I'll relish or take pride in. But it was good. You know, he's a very sensitive guy. He doesn't overcomplicate things. He just sits and reacts. So as I was showing him pieces of music, it was either I would look at him and he would be watching his movie like an audience, or I would look at him and he would be thinking, okay, this needs to be, this isn't right. It was easy to see on his face, even though he's got a very, you know, a good poker face. You could see he was either lost in his movie or he was lost in like how to fix it. So
right.
it was a fun process.
Is it easier because this is obviously a film that, I mean, I've read praises about it just a couple of hours ago. I read some reviews of it that are fantastic.
Oh,
is it easier somehow for the composer to work in the service of films when they're very good?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. There are some movies that when you try to make your contribution, if it's a difficult film, if it's not assembled well, it can be easier because the role is clear.
Mm-hmm.
There are some movies that it's really difficult because the movie's not very well put together and the role is completely unclear.
Mm-hmm.
But a movie like this, it was both that the role was clear and the movie was really well assembled. So it was just a joy all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can imagine, and maybe I'm just naive, I can imagine a not so very good film and perhaps an inexperienced director saying, well, maybe we can fix this moment with music.
Right.
Does that happen? And is that,
oh, it happens
that's
all,
not
yeah.
very, that's not very wise, is it?
Well, it's true. It's not too wise. Although if it's done right, like in a scenario where the movie's not well made, but the role of the music is clear, you really can fix a lot of problems. I think in the inverse, you can actually cause a lot of problems if you abuse a filmic moment with the wrong music. You know, and a lot of people don't notice it. They don't pinpoint it. You know, they might say, oh, I don't like the color of the paint in that kitchen, you know,
right.
But really it's music.
Yeah.
But that, they do attempt very often to fix problems with music. And actually it can really happen quite frequently that you fix a problem with music, because suddenly you're not thinking about the actual moment that you're seeing, but you're thinking more about the backstory or the foreboding quality of what's happening and not what you're actually seeing. So, you know, that's all. In fact, you know, we all know that movies are a series of smoke and mirrors. And
right, it's all
like magic.
A manipulation, yeah, very magical manipulation.
Yeah, like sleight of hand.
Exactly. But you work on the mainstream films and you've worked on indie films. And I'm wondering if there's a difference for you, if somehow in the indie films perhaps you're able to take more risks.
Absolutely. It's a relative thing. You know, I thought it was a little risky to play White Christmas.
Yeah.
On the main title of Four Christmases.
I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah. And another thing, I build this big crescendo, and then on the title of the film, I get super small
mm-hmm.
on Four Christmases,
mm-hmm.
and that was a risk. So, and that, those feel like big risks because, you know, the studio could say you're fired, right?
Right.
On mm-hmm. an indie movie, the studio says, whoever says you're fired, and you're like, okay, good, now I can try and make some money, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
It's terribly rewarding. But, yeah, you can be much more creative and try different sounds. And I love the smallness that you can achieve with indie movies and have that feel big. I like the psychoacoustic factor of indie movies.
Well, there's, we talked to many, many composers on this show, and obviously in the past decade or more, certainly, electronic music has come more and more into play,
mm-hmm.
where people have kind of switched away from the big orchestra, and I know you had a big orchestra here on Four Christmases, whether it be for financial reasons or just a stylistic choice.
Mm-hmm.
Do you enjoy that kind of music as much as an orchestra, or what kind of demands does a film put on that choice? What does the film have to be to warrant electronic versus an orchestral?
That's a tough question. That's really a tough question because it's hard to describe. For What Doesn't Kill You, in the temp score, there were a few notions that they had that felt right, and these came from scores that in the second 20 seconds of the music came a string section, and every time the strings came, it felt wrong. It felt manipulative, too big.
Mm-hmm.
So I was going to say that I lost my train of thought for a moment. I think that, sorry.
That happens to us all the time.
It happens to me every minute, so don't worry about it.
I feel like the scope of the moment in any given film will tell you, is this one where, you know, we're feeling big or small? I don't know if I'm making any sense at this point.
No. I mean,
no.
Yeah,
you are making
right.
sense. You are.
Yeah.
But it is kind of a trend, somewhat in film music, or it has been in recent memory. Do you see any kind of trends in film music at the present time, or do trends apply to film music?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The trend that I saw, I don't know how many years ago, maybe 5 or 6. You remember this fantastic film, Unsung Heroes?
Oh, yeah. Diane Keaton directed that one?
Yeah, Diane Keaton directed
it. That was actually a very, very emotional movie.
Oh, it nailed me.
Yeah.
Thomas Newman did the score, and he was using samples and really cool stuff. And then every once in a while, like when we, you know, when we're really dealing with the cancer issue in that movie, he brought in a string section and just, you know, ripped your heart out just for a moment. Right.
Yeah.
The rest of it was really quirky and unusual and really great, by the way. It's an excellent buy if you buy that soundtrack. You know, I started really watching Thomas Newman, and I noticed that his melodies were really shrouded in style.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that became the trend, was to really take a lot of emphasis off of melody. That was tough for me because that wasn't my bag.
Right.
So I've sort of come partly that way, but I'm still sticking with the melody. And I have a little faith that that the melody is coming back. I have a little faith, not little faith.
Well, I hope so. I hope so, because certainly there are films that rely more on creating an atmosphere that perhaps minimal kind of electronic music might satisfy, but... just like in popular music, I yearn for melodies to come back more than,
yeah.
you know, beats and all of that kind of stuff. But it's true of film music, too. And Thomas Newman is actually, in a lot of the work I've listened to, he's very good with melody and theme.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Meet Joe Black, which is a score I love. I'm
yeah.
a sucker for those kinds of scores.
Yeah.
Do you have favorite scores? If I asked you to recommend... three scores to me now, what would those three be?
Well, that's a tough one. I mean, it's kind of, I would gear it towards the listener a little bit. You know, if it was a
right.
listener with not much exposure to remarkable film score, I would come off with the first one would be The Mission,
mm-hmm.
where you get an amazing application of music and a dramatic scope of music. I'm also extremely fond of Unsung Hero, I mentioned, from Thomas Newman. That's one I always mention. I thought that Ennio Morricone's finest execution of a particular style that I love of his was Bugsy.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great one.
It's really nicely recorded and played and just, you know, just beautiful, extremely interesting score.
Yeah.
I know that those are the first three that come to my mind. I'm sure there's, I mean, you know, my favorite of John Williams is Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Huh.
And I'm also totally into Planet of the Apes.
Jerry Goldsmith, the first, yeah, those scores were wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Jerry Goldsmith was a person, I mean, you're talking about hundreds of scores and incredibly versatile, and you've done movies all over the map in terms of genre. Is there a genre that's kind of missing for you, or do you long to do a certain genre or kind of music for a film?
I saw Atonement last year and thought, gosh, I would have loved to have done that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, romantic saga is something that I would really like to do.
Yeah.
And I kind of got that in a slightly New Agey and penguin-y way on March of the Penguins.
Right.
But I would love to do it with a traditional orchestra and with a more European quality. I would love that.
Ah, that sounds wonderful. Alex, the movies are Four Christmases and What Doesn't Kill You, and you do great work, and we appreciate you coming on so much.
Well,
really,
it's really been a pleasure talking to you guys.
Yeah,
well,
come back anytime. We love composers. We're crazy about your work, and we'd welcome you back anytime.
That's fantastic. I'll take you up on it.
All right, my friend.
Great.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, Alex Werman, Four Christmases and What Doesn't Kill You. I guess that film comes out this weekend, What Doesn't Kill You.
I think that's a limited release, isn't it?
It's a Mark Ruffalo, right?
I think so. I think. Let me check. I actually have it up. Let me.
It is him. I don't know who's in it with him. I forgot.
Ethan Hawke.
Well, at least Mark Ruffalo's in it.
I know Ethan Hawke. Well, it's got a lot of.
I know. I was making a joke.
I know you're making. Great. Ethan Hawke's gonna probably call in next. Donnie Wahlberg.
Okay. Well, there you go.
Yeah, now you got a couple of people in there. This is. I don't think this is a limited release, isn't it?
Yes.
At
yes,
first,
it
probably, yeah.
It looks like
a great film. It's getting great notices. And obviously, I mean, it's not the best time for Mark Ruffalo right now, but...
No, I know.
Tragic, but he's an outstanding actor. I mean, you like Ruffalo a lot, don't you, Chris?
Oh, I'm nuts about Mark Ruffalo, and I thought his best work so far has been in Zodiac, completely unrecognized, but...
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
No, he's excellent.
He's one of those guys that's just waiting for the right role, and then everybody's going to know his name.
Yeah.
He's with there's a movie he was in a couple years ago, We Don't Live Here Anymore.
Right.
That he was good. I like that, too.
He's amazing in that movie.
Yeah. I love that movie. I mean, yeah.
And I was that was my personal private campaign last year, was to have somebody recognize him in Zodiac. Because I personally thought it was the performance of the year for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was great in that.
He has that toughness without having to be tough. He just exudes this kind of toughness.
Yeah, yeah.
In that role, I mean.
Well, he's... and another thing about it is, because if you take the characteristics of the guy, the voice, the animal crackers, and all of that kind of stuff, it would be easy to see an actor playing those things, playing too mannered, and it's a put on performance.
Right, or doing a Dirty Harry type thing, really trying to take it over the top.
That's right. You know? That's right. And you're right. There's something very, very tough about him, and yet completely relatable. I mean, I don't want to say feminine quality, but in a way that you feel very comfortable with him.
Yeah,
and
tough,
not
but
a,
not that classic alpha male tough in a way that is a
right.
lot quieter and a lot more
think more thinking man's tough, if anything.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, which, speaking of Dirty Harry and Clint Eastwood, this Gran Torino I announced earlier got an A- in EW, and people are raving about it all over the place. That's really the surprise of the season for me. I mean, this movie really has a shot.
Surprise, but it's not a surprise. I think, how do I say this? Do you think that they want to, because they've, all right, they obviously, since Unforgiven, he has been an awards darling.
Mm-hmm.
But do you think,
not
all the time.
He really had a big slump there in between Unforgiven and his
Mystic River.
later Mystic River. I mean, people forget he was making stuff like Space Cowboys and Blood Work for several years.
Space Cowboys was out of the things you're talking about, the slump, is very entertaining. No, I'm not going to play the same league as Mystic River, but it's a lot more entertaining than the stuff that came before that. But I didn't mind the one he acted in that he didn't direct in The Line of Fire.
That was the last time he did that, actually.
Yeah, and then actually, in The Perfect World, I didn't mind.
No, not bad movies, not the Oscar darling type movies he's been having in the last.
About true crime and Absolute Power and.
I know. Trust me,
those all have the same characteristics, though. I mean, they're completely story, and they're not told in a fussy way.
He's too loyal to the books and with those films. First of all, they're all bestsellers that Warner Brothers managed to get him the rights to, and they're just not. They're not compelling stories.
Right.
They're just not compelling stories. I'll be the first to say that. I think that what's interesting is I just think they like to keep when he does. I mean, obviously not with Bloodwork. Even after Bloodwork, he said, "I'll never act again," and people don't, because it didn't do well. He said, "People don't want to see me act." But then he does Million Dollar Baby. And now he does this one, Gran Torino, and everyone's excited. He's in front of the camera, and it reminds him of Dirty Harry.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what it is. I think there's this weird. It started at the beginning of this year with Rambo, and we end with this Dirty Harry-esque performance.
Possibly.
I think that's just a nostalgia. I think there's a nostalgia thing in this, and it's very odd because these are the same critics who would rip something like Death Wish or Death Sentence to pieces.
Right.
I mean, don't you guys agree? There's something very strange here because if someone else was in this film, this is another film, a low-budget film, they would rip it to shreds. But because it's Clint, he's getting the benefit of the doubt here.
Well, it's possible.
I don't know. I'm not so sure, though, because the last time he got good notices for acting was Million Dollar Baby. And the thing is, it's easy to make those Dirty Harry comparisons because he does play a tough guy. It's hard for him not to play a tough guy.
You're right. And I don't mean that as a criticism.
No, I understand, but he has these moments of emotion in Million Dollar Baby that are just gut-wrenching, and I feel like, I mean, these reviewers, these are, A-list reviewers that are saying the same things about this movie, so they're seeing something that's different here.
Well, I hope it's good. I'm looking forward to it, so I hope it's good.
Yeah, me too.
That'll be good. Well, we'll find out tomorrow. I mean, that's the first huge indication of its Oscar chances. I mean, the Critic Awards, sure, but I mean, the Golden Globes.
Do you think there's any film that you haven't seen that's been nominated yet or gotten recognition that might be on there tomorrow? Is there anything you think could come out of left field?
Well, there's always going to be stuff out of left field on the Golden Globes. And the stuff that's out of left field is not necessarily stuff that should be, like we were saying earlier, there's going to be, Robert Downey Jr. type nominations, either for Iron Man or for Tropic Thunder. And those are good performances, but there's always going to be, the Golden Globes have a tendency to nominate things just because they seem right. You know what I mean?
Right.
They seem to nominate things before they've even been seen, just because it's got the pedigree behind it.
Right.
Like, for instance, they would have nominated, if Changeling was coming out next week, Changeling would be nominated for Best Picture at the Golden Globes. Even though that's probably not a real contender, they seem to nominate things just because they meet the criteria. Things like Revolutionary.
No, you're absolutely right. You're right.
Things like Revolutionary Road, which it's starting to seem like maybe just doesn't live up to the expectations from early reviews. I wouldn't be surprised if that gets a nomination. And then those movies just sort of disappear come Oscar time, because they weren't ever up to par to begin with. Those are the kind of surprises you get with the Golden Globes.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
This is the group that nominated, I don't know if she won, she might have won, Pia Zadora for The Lonely Lady years ago.
She was really good in The Naked Gun 3. All right.
Naked Gun. Looks like Phil Donahue's throwing up at the tuba. Yes.
But then also, the Golden Globes have a tendency to nominate those smaller pictures, too, and those smaller performances, which that gives them a chance to build. People are like, who the hell is Marion Cotillard or whatever,
Right.
And all of a sudden, everybody's talking about that movie. Come Oscar time, she wins, So that's a positive, too. Golden Globes, I don't know. I got a love hate relationship with the Golden Globes. I know you guys probably do too. But
there's good
things and bad things. It's kind of hard to take them completely seriously. But at the same time, it's the first big show. It's the first big indication, and the emotions start to swell, and you start to get really excited. You know.
Mm. Are we going to watch them together this year, Chris?
Oh, hell to the yes. Hell yes, of course. I wouldn't miss it.
Cool. All right, Chris, you'll be back with us, my movie geek friend, on Sunday, where we will review these Golden Globe nominations schoolgirls.
We will not be speculating. We'll be talking about the real deal.
Yeah. We'll give our predictions, who should win and who will win, which are often two different things. Who was snubbed, which I'm sure there'll be many.
There will be.
But thanks, guys, for tonight's show.
We'll try to
reschedule our guests that didn't call in. We'll reschedule them. But this weekend we have Rod Laurie, Salvatore Stable, two great directors. And the Rod Laurie conversation was just great. You guys will really enjoy that one. And then our Golden Globe Roundtable on Sunday night at 6.
Looking forward to it.
Good.
All right, we end the show with a little piece of music that Mr. Werman actually spoke about. This is from Four Christmases, and we'll see everybody back here Sunday.
All right, good night, everyone.
Good night.